Chapter 6 The Mayorn Wilderness. A quote from Agensis, the third analytic of men. Everything is concealed always. Nothing is more trite than a mask. A quote from Menagoras, Ode to the Long-Lived Fool. If you find yourself taken unawares by someone you thought you knew, recall that the character revealed is as much your own as otherwise. When it comes to men and their myriad mercenary natures, revelation always comes in twos. Late Spring, 20 New Imperial Year, 4132, Year of the Tusk. The Long Side. It tracked their blundering flight through the wilderness. It watched and it hungered, and it hated. How it hated. It remained in the trees for the most part, running with glee along the dead limbs of the under-canopy. It fed on squirrels, eaten raw, and once upon a wild cat that had tried to feed on it. It supped on the mewling litter afterward, laughed at their miniature hisses and struggles. Their tiny skulls cracked like delicacies. Days. Weeks. Over gnarled miles, through rain falling in sheeted fury, it watched them trudge, and it watched them sleep. It watched them feud and bicker. Three times it saw them battle the errant children of the old fathers, the Shrank, and it crouched, its eyes wide and wondering as tangles of sorcerous light and shadow flooded through the forest's mangled depths. And sometimes it dared crawl close, like a serpent, worming toward prey, grinding its phallus against the hoary bark. It would watch her, the girl, who had saved them in the ancient old deeps. And it would know lust, malice. It would gaze with a singularity unknown to men. The thing called Soma. Each night it sought some tree greater than the others, a tower among lesser pillars, and it climbed, leaping and swinging through the canopies, from dead to living, following fork and branch, to the wiry limit, until it breached the final leafy weave. There, gently creaking side to side in the breeze, it stared across an ocean of arboreal crowns. It would bend its neck back until its head pressed its spine, and it would scream. And scream. Watch after watch, night after night, shrieking in tones that not even dogs could hear. Only rats. Screaming. Until its mouth filled with blood. The hags could not keep up. They would begin complaining around midday, at least at first. Belmorn, the particularly brutish Galeoth who had become their de facto leader, even went so far as to accuse the skin-eaters of devilry. With a kind of immovable indifference, Akamian watched the captain stroll up to the arm-waving giant and plunge a knife in his armpit. "Your lives are mine!" he screamed at the others. "Mine to beat! Mine to torture! Mine to murder!" That night two of the hags disappeared. Akamian could not remember their names. Nothing was said of them the next day, or any of the days following. Scalpers did not speak of the dead, even ones so despicable as the stone hags. The rains began after that, and below dark skies the world beneath forest canopies was darker still. Lightning strikes were little more than sparks and glows, glimpsed through the gauze of a million leaves, but thunder crashed undulled through the brachiated gloom. Gutted by the trees, the rainwaters fell in the form of countless hanging rivulets, a pissing army of them, soaking the ground to wheezing muck. And if the way became more arduous for the skin-eaters with their nightly ration of curry, it became harder still for the hags. One, a ritually scarred Thunieri named Osilwas, they lost to a river crossing. With the wound festering in his arm, the man had staggered as much as marched for days. One evening Akamian had watched him cut his hair away, lock by lock, to shed weight, he supposed. Despite the man's condition, the old wizard had thought Osilwas would survive, perhaps mistaking the gleam of fever in his eyes for the light of determination. One stumble in roiling waters was all it took to sweep him away. Another, a bow-legged Sepulorin, the others called Scroll, apparently because of the elaborate blue tattooing across his limbs, simply began wailing like a madman one night and had to be put down as a sobber. The day after, Eridides, who continually claimed to be a Sarongi pirate in the chaotic days preceding the new empire, developed a limp. No matter how hard he labored, he fell even farther behind. Akamian's last memory of him was a grimace, a kind of panic grin stretched across expressions of abject pain, a look that urged wild effort and the utter absence of strength. Then there was the dispute between Pakwas and Wagulu, the strutting Thunieri, who for a time had assumed titular command of his brothers. Akamian did not know what caused the altercation, only that it occurred in the course of dividing a joint of wild boar. Pakwas, in particular, was inclined to heap abuse on the hags, alternately calling them dogs, wretches, and Mibus. Apparently a Mibu was a kind of Zayumi jackal, renowned for eating its own kind during the dry season. "Be a good Mibu," Akamian had overheard him say on more than one occasion, "and we will feed your dead to you." One moment everything was gloom and milling exhaustion. The next the two men were grappling, their heels kicking up leaves and dirt as they heaved at each other. Pakwas was easily the stronger. The green-eyed giant twisted Wagulu around, wrenched him to the ground. Then he began pounding the prostrate Thunieri about the head and face. Again and again, while everyone gnawed and chewed their dinner, their hands and faces gleaming with grease. Nothing was said, and aside from the black giant's labored breathing, nothing was heard beyond the slapping thud of his fists. Again and again. The sword dancer continued striking the man long after he was dead, while Akamian and the others continued watching and eating. Only Maimara turned away. Afterwards, Sarl began cackling in his strange, inward way, muttering,
"I told you, Kiampus, eh? Yes?"
Something was happening. Akamian could feel it in his bones, catch glimpses of it in the eyes of the others. Maimara especially. He had watched a human head hammered into a wineskin, and he had felt nothing more than curiosity. It was the Kiri. It had to be. The medicine seemed to numb their conscience as much as it quickened their limbs and stretched their wind. Even as Akamian felt himself becoming closer to Maimara, he found himself caring less for the surviving skin-eaters, and not at all for the wretched hags. The old wizard had enough experience with hashish and opium to know the way drugs could alter the small things, stretch and twist the detailed fabric of life. In the flesh pots of Carathuzel, he had seen the way the poppy, especially, could conquer the myriad desires of men, until their hunger for the drug eclipsed even lust and love. He knew enough to be wary, but the fact was that they were moving fast, far faster than Akamian had dared hope. Several days into the rains, they had found the ruins of a bridge on the banks of a great river, a bridge that Akamian recognized from his dreams as the Archipontus of Wool, a work famed across the ancient north in Seswatha's day. That meant that they had traveled over half the distance from Maemor to Kelmiol, the ancient capital of the Maori Empire, in the space of 2 weeks, a spectacular distance. If they could maintain this pace, they would easily reach Sogleish and the coffers before summer's end. But it was a pace that was killing the newcomers. More and more the remaining hags took on the vigilant aspect of hostages, a look at once surly, bewildered, and terrified. They ceased speaking, even among themselves, and as much as the skin-eaters found their gaze inexorably drawn to Cleric, their eyes continually circled about the captain and the threat of his discipline. Night would fall, the rains would thread the dark with lines of silver, and the hags would huddle in shivering clutches, while Galien, Conger, and the others would bare their arms and marvel at their steaming skin.
"Where are we going?"
The youngest of them, a Galeoth adolescent with the strange name of Heresius, began shrieking one evening.
"What madness!"
he screamed in broken Shaic.
"What madness you do!"
Staring was the most any of the original company could manage, so sudden and crazed was the young man's outburst. Finally, with the same murderous deliberation a Commian had seen many times, the captain stood. The youth, who was no fool, bolted like a spooked doe into the murk. Afterward, Galien insisted he had seen something. Arms, he thought, hook out of the dead under-canopy and yank the young wretch into oblivion. No one mourned him. No one, stone hag or skin-eater, so much as spoke his name. The dead had no place in their history. They were scalpers. As much as they feared their mad captain, none of them disputed his simple and dread logic. Death to sobbers. Death to loafers. Death to limpers, bellyachers, and bleeders. Death to weakness, the great enemy of enmity. So day after day they threw themselves at horizons they could not see, trudged with bottomless vigor into lands obscured and obscure, whether the sky cracked and poured water, or the sun shone through sheets of green luminescence. Day after day the stone hags dwindled, for they were weak, and the skin-eaters were strong. There was no place for pity, even less for regret, on the slog. And this, as sorrow continually slurred under his breath, was the slog of slogs. You could not be wholly human and survive the long side, so you became something less, and pretended you were more. In subsequent days, a Commian would come to look at this leg of their journey with a peculiar horror, not because they had lived necessary lies, but because he had come to believe them. He was a man who would rather know and enumerate his sins, bear the pain of them, than cocoon himself in numbing ignorance and flattering exculpation. You can only believe so many lies before becoming one of them. What began as a remedy in the Kilogen deeps had somehow transcended habit and become sacred ritual. The holy dispensation, Maimara once called it, in a peak of impatience. Each night they queued before the non-man, awaiting their pinch of curie. Usually cleric would sit cross-legged and wordlessly dip his index finger into his pouch, darkening the pad with the merest smear. One by one the skin-eaters would kneel before him and take the tip of his outstretched finger into their mouths, to better avoid any waste. A Commian would take his place among the others, kneel as they did when his time came. The curie would be bitter, the finger cold for the spit of others, sweet for the soil of daily use. A kind of euphoria would flutter through him, one that stirred troubling memories of kneeling before Kellis during the first holy war. There would be a moment, a mere heartbeat, where he would buckle beneath the dark gaze of the nonman. But he would walk away content, like a starving child who had tasted honey. Thoughtless, he would sit and savor the slow crawl of vitality through his veins. The first and only stone hag to dare ridicule the act was found dead the following morning. Afterward, the renegade scalpers restricted their opinions to sullen looks and expressions, fear and disgust mostly. Sometimes the non-man would climb upon some wild pulpit, the mossed remains of a fallen tree, the humpback of a boulder, and paint wonders with his dark voice. Wonders and horrors both. Often he spoke of war and tribulation, of loves unraveled and victories undone. No matter how the scalpers pressed him with questions, he could never recall the frame of his reminiscences. He spoke in episodes and events, never ages or times. The result was a kind of inadvertent verse, moments too packed with enigma and ambiguity to form narrative wholes, at least none they could comprehend. fragments that never failed to leave his human listeners unsettled and amazed. My Mara continually pestered the old wizard with questions afterward.
"Who is he?" she would hiss. "His stories must tell you something."
Time and again, the Kamian could only profess ignorance. He remembers the breaking of things, nothing more. The rest of the puzzle is always missing, for him, as much as for us. I know only that he's old, exceedingly old.
How old?
Older than iron, older than even human writing.
You mean older than the Tusk?
All non-men living were impossibly ancient. Even the youngest of their number were contemporaries of the old prophets. But if his sermons could be believed, cleric or Incariol, Lord Wanderer was far older still, in his prime before the Ark and the coming of the Inkoroi. An actual contemporary, Ninjanjin and Kujara Kimwai. "Go to sleep," the wizard grumbled. What did it matter who cleric had been, he told himself, when the ages had battered him into something entirely different? "You look upon me and see something whole." "Singular," the non-man said one night, his head hanging from his shoulders, his face utterly lost to shadow. When he looked up, tears had silvered his cheeks. "You are mistaken."
"What did he mean?"
My Mara asked after she and the wizard had curled onto their mats. They always slept side by side now. Akamian had even become accustomed to the point of absence that was her koray. Ever since that first Shrank attack, when she had been stranded with Soma beyond the protective circuit of the incipient wards, he had been loath to let her stray from his side. "He means he's not a self, in the way you and I are selves. Now, go to sleep."
"But how is that possible?"
"Because of memory. Memory is what binds us to what we are. Go to sleep."
"What do you mean? How can somebody not be what they are? That makes no sense."
"Go to sleep." He would lay there, his eyes closed to the world, while the image of the non-man, mundane beauty, perpetually at war with his arcane disfiguration, plagued his soul. The old wizard would curse himself for a fool, ask himself how many watches he had wasted worrying about the erratic. Cleric was one of the Faroika, the wayward. Whatever the non-man once was, he was no longer. And that should be enough. If he had ceased pondering in Cariol altogether in the days following the battle in the ruins of Maymor, it was because of the skin spy and what its presence implied. But time's passage had a way of blunting our sharper questions, of making things difficult to confront, soft with malleable familiarity. Of course, the consult had been watching him, the man who had taught the gnosis to the Aspect Emperor, and so delivered the three C's. Of course they had infiltrated the skin-eaters. He was Drusus Akamian. But the further Soma fell into the past, the more Cleric's presence irked his curiosity, the more the old questions began prickling back to life. Even his dreams had been affected. He had lost his inkhorn in papyrus in the mad depths of Kilogis, so he could no longer chronicle the particulars of his slumbering experience. Nor did he need to. It almost seemed as if he had become unmoored when he pondered the transformations. First, he had drifted from the central current of Seswatha's life, away from the tragic enormities, and into the mundane details, where he had been delivered to the knowledge of Ishwal. The secret fastness of the Dunyain. Then, as if these things were too small to catch the fabric of his soul, he slipped from Seswatha altogether, seeing things his ancient forebear had never seen, standing where he never stood, as when he saw the library of Soglish burn. And now, he continued to dream that he and nameless others stood shackled in a shadowy line, Broken men, brutalized. They filed through a tube of thatched undergrowth, bushes that had grown out and around their passage, forming vaults of 1,000 interlocking branches. Over the stooped shoulders of those before him, he could see the tunnel's terminus. The threshold of some sunlit clearing, it seemed. The spaces beyond were so open and bright as to defeat his gloom-pitched eyes. He felt a dread that seemed curiously disconnected from his surroundings, as if his fear had come to him from a far different time and place. And he did not know who he was. A titanic horn would blare, and the line would be pulled stumbling forward, and peering, he would see a starved wretch at the fore. At least 100 souls distant, stepping into the golden light. Vanishing, and the screaming would begin, only to be yanked short. Again and again he dreamed this senseless dream. Sometimes it was identical. Sometimes he seemed one soul closer to the procession's end. He could never be sure. Was it the Kyrie? Was it the deathless rancor of a mop, or a cruel whim of fate? Or had the trauma of his life at last unhinged him, and cast his slumber to the wolves of grim fancy? For his whole life, ever since grasping the withered pouch of Seswatha's heart, deep in the bowel of a Tiresis, his dreams had possessed meaning, logic, horrifying to be sure, but comprehensible all the same. For his whole life he had awakened with purpose. And now? "So what was it like?" Akamian asked her, as the company filed through the arboreal maze. "What was what like?" They always addressed each other in a nani now. The fact that only the captain could comprehend them made it seem daring somehow, and curiously proper, as if madmen should oversee the exchange of secrets. Even still, they took care that he did not overhear. "Life on the Endymion Heights?" he said. "As an Anasarimber?" "You mean the family you're trying to destroy?" The old wizard snorted. "Just think, no more running." At last she smiled. Anger and sarcasm, Akamian had learned, were a kind of reflex for Maimara, as well as a fortress and a refuge. If he could outlast her initial hostility, which proved difficult no matter how much good humor he mustered, he could usually coax a degree of openness from her. "It was complicated," she began pensively.
"Well, then, start at the beginning."
"You mean when they came for me in Carathuzel?"
The old wizard shrugged and nodded. They had slackened their pace enough to fall behind the others, even the dour file of stone hags, who stole longing glances as Maimara drifted past. Despite the chorus of birdsong, a kind of silence reared about them, the hush of slow growth and decay. It felt like shelter.
"You have to understand," she said hesitantly. "I didn't know that I had been wronged. The brutalities I endured... But I was a child, and then I was a brothel slave. That's what I was, something made to be violated, abused over and over, until I grew too old or too ugly, and they sold me to the foolery. That was just the way. So when the Aeothic guardsmen came and began beating Yappy, Yapotis, the brothel master, I didn't understand. I couldn't understand."
Akamian watched her carefully, saw a rare strand of sunlight flash across her face. "You thought you were being attacked instead of saved?" A numb nod.
"They took me away before the killing began, but I knew..." I could tell from the soldier's manner, cold, as merciless as any of these scalpers. "I knew they would kill anyone who had a hand in my fouling."
She had the habit of slipping into Tetsimi when she became upset, the rough dialect peculiar to menials and slaves from Carathusel. The clipped vowels, the sing-song intonations. Akamian would have teased her for sounding like an Aenoni harlot, had the subject matter been less serious.
"They brought me to a ship. You should have seen them, stammering, bowing and kneeling.
Not the soldiers, but the Imperial apparati, who commanded them. They asked me, begged me, for some kind of request, for something they could do, for my health and my ease, they said. For my glory. I'll never forget that. My whole life, my only prize had been the lust my form incited in men. The face of an empress, the hips and slit of a young girl. And there I stood, the proud possessor of what? Glory? So I said, stop, stop the killing. And they looked at me with long faces and said, alas, princess, that's the one thing we cannot do. Why? I asked them. Because the blessed empress has commanded it, they said. So I stood on the prow and watched. They had moored on the high river, on the quays, typically reserved for the scarlet spires. You know those? So I could see the slums rise to the north, all the worm laid out for inspection. I could see it burn. I could even see souls trapped in their roofs. Men, women, children, jumping. The old wizard watched her, careful to purge any hint of pity from his frown. To be a child whore one moment, and a princess imperial the next, to be plucked from abject slavery and hurtled to the heights of the greatest empire since Cannae, and then to have your old world burned down around you. Esmanet, he understood, had tried to undo her crime with the commission of another. She had mistook vengeance for reparation. So you understand, Maimara continued, swallowing. My first years on the Endymion Heights were hateful, shameful even. You understand why I did everything I could to punish Mother. Akamian studied her for a moment before nodding. The company had crested a gradual slope, and now descended, using webs of bared roots as steps. A rare glimpse of the sun flashed above, making silhouettes of shagged leaves. I understand, he said as they picked their way down, feeling the raw weight of his own story, his own grievances, pressed to the tone of his reply. They were both victims of Esmanet. They walked in silence, their strides as thoughtless as they were quick. Thank you, Maimara said after a time, fixing him with a curious gaze. For what? For not asking what all the others ask. Which is? How I could have stayed all those years. How I could have allowed myself to be used as I was used. Apparently everyone would have run away, slit their master's throat, committed suicide. Nothing makes fools of people quite like luxurious life, Kamian said, shaking his head and nodding. A Genesis says they confuse decisions made atop pillows for those compelled by stones. When they hear of other people being deceived, they're certain they would know better. When they hear of other people being oppressed, they're certain they would do anything but beg and cringe when the club is raised. And so they judge, Maimara said sourly. They certainly picked the wrong woman in your case. This coaxed another smile, another small triumph. She began talking about her younger siblings, haltingly at first, then with more confidence and detail. She seemed surprised by her own reminiscences, and troubled. She had forsworn her family, he knew that much. But watching and listening to her describe the embittered object of her anger, he came to suspect she had gone so far as to deny her family, to tell herself that she was in fact alone, without the guy ropes of kith and kin to prop her. Small wonder she had been so reluctant to tell him anything. People are generally loath to describe what they need to forget, especially the small things, the loving things that contradict their precious state of injustice. She started with Caeutus, the child Esmanet had carried in her womb the day Akamian had repudiated her before the assembled lords of the Holy War. He would have seemed a kind of god to her, she said, had her stepfather not been Kellis. A real god. He is the very image of his father, she said, nodding as if agreeing with her own description. Not so remote, certainly. More human, the old wizard said, scowling. She then turned to Moingus, whom she described as the most normal and difficult of her younger siblings. Apparently he was quite the terror as a youth, given to episodes of inconsolable anger, and continually brooding, if not sulking. Esmonette regularly left the boys in her care, with the hope of fostering some tenderness for her younger siblings, my Mara presumed. She despised the swimming expeditions most of all. Apparently Moengus enjoyed diving under the water and not reappearing for the longest time. The first incident was the worst. She even called on her bodyguards to help her, only to watch Moengus's head break the flashing water several spans away. He ignored her commands and curses and repeated the stunt again and again. Each time she would tell herself he was simply playing, but her heart would continue counting beats, and the panic would well higher and higher until she was fairly beside herself with fear and fury. Then his head would magically pop into sight, his black hair glazed in white sunlight, and he would glare at her, shouting antics before descending again. Finally, she turned on his brother, demanding an explanation. "Because," Kaotis said, with a detachment that clammed her skin, "he wants people to think him dead." The old wizard responded with a nodding snort. When he asked her whether anyone knew about his true parentage, she merely frowned and said, "Questioning our holy parentage is sacrilege." "Lies," Akamian mused. "Deceit heaped atop deceit. In the early days of his exile, he would sometimes lie awake at night, convinced that sooner or later someone would see through Kellis and his glamour, that the truth would win out, and all the madness would come crashing down. That he could come home and reclaim his wife. But as the years passed, he came to see this, for the rank foolishness that it was. He, a student of Agensis, no less. Truths were carved from the identical wood, as were lies, words, and so sank or floated with equal ease. But since truths were carved by the world, they rarely appeased men and their innumerable vanities. Men had no taste for facts that did not ornament or enrich, and so they willfully, if not knowingly, panelled their lives with shining and intricate falsehoods. My Mara's eldest sister, the Liapa, would be the only one of her siblings to occasion a true smile. According to my Mara, the girl was almost incapable of expressing passion of any sort, and was oblivious, sometimes comically so, to all but the most obvious social graces. She was also dreadfully thin, famine thin, and had to be continually cajoled and bullied to eat. But her intellect was nothing short of a miracle. Everything she read, she remembered, and she read voraciously, often to the point of forgetting to sleep. Her gifts were so prodigious that Kellis made her an imperial advisor at the tender age of 12, after which she became a continual presence in her mother's entourage. Pale, emaciated, decked in absurd gowns of her own design and manufacture. "It's hard not to pity her," my Mara said, her gaze flat with memories. "Even as you marvel."
"What do people say?"
"Say?
About her peculiarities. What do they think caused them?"
Few things inspired more malicious speculation than deformities. Kanraya even had a law, back before the new empire, anyway, rendering misshaped children the property of the king. Apparently the court diviners thought a careful reading of their deformations could reveal much about the future. "They say my stepfather's seed is too heavy for mortal women to bear," my Mara said. "He took other wives. Zikas, they call them, after the small bowls they pass out for libations on the day of ascension. But those who became pregnant, none carried a term. Either that or they died. Only mother." Akamian could only nod, his thoughts roiling. Kellis had to have known this, he realized. From the very beginning, he had known Esmonent possessed the strength to survive him and his progeny. And so he set out to conquer her womb, as one more tool, one more weapon, and his unceasing war of word, insight, and passion.
"You needed her, so you took."
Regarding her sister Serwa, my Mara said very little, save that she was cold and arrogant. She's the Grand Mistress of the Swaljali. Now, Grand Mistress. I don't think Mother ever forgave Kellis for sending her away. I saw very little of her, and when I did, my teeth fairly cracked for envy. Studying with the sisters. Attaining the only thing I truly desired. In Rilitus, on the other hand, she discussed for quite some time, partly because Esmenet had sought to involve her in the boy's upbringing. According to my Mara, none of her siblings possessed more of their father's gifts, or more of their mother's all-too-human weaknesses. Speaking long before any infant should, never forgetting, and seeing deeper, far deeper than any human could or should. His subsequent madness, she said, was inevitable. He was perpetually at a loss, perpetually overwhelmed by the presence of others. Unlike his father, he could only see the brute truths, the facts and lies that compelled the course of lives. But these were quite enough. He would look into my eyes and say impossible things, hateful things. How do you mean? He told me once that I punished Mother not to avenge my slavery, but because
what?
Because I was broken inside, she said, her lips set in a grim and brittle line. Because I had suffered so much so long that kindness had become the only cruelty I could not endure. Kindness! And so suffering would be all I would ever know. She trailed, turned her face away to swat at the tears clotting her eyes. So I told him, she continued, avoiding Akamian's gaze. I told him that I had never known kindness because everything I had been given had been just another way to take, to steal. You cannot stroke a beaten dog, he replied, because it sees only the raised hand. A beaten dog. Can you believe it? What kind of little boy calls his grown sister a beaten dog? A Dunyain, the old wizard thought, in unspoken reply. She must have glimpsed something of his sorrow in his eyes, the outrage in her expression, which had been helpless in the face of memory, turned in sudden fury upon him. "You pity me?" she cried, as if her pain was something with its own outrage and volition. "Pity? Don't, my Mara, don't do this. Do what? What?" "Make Enrilitus true." This smacked a fury from her expression. She stared at him speechless, her body jerking as her legs carried her thoughtlessly forward, her eyes wide with a kind of desolate horror. "What about the others?" the old wizard asked, snipping all memory of her outburst from his tone. The best way to retrieve a conversation from disaster, he often found, was to speak as if the disaster had never happened. "I know there's more. The twins? Tell me about them." She marched in silence for a time, collecting herself, Akamian supposed. The footing had become even more treacherous. A stream had gullied the forest floor, cutting away the loam beneath the feet of several massive elms, so that the roots hung in tentacled sheets to their right. Akamian could see the rest of the party below, picking their way under a toppled giant, with the same haste that was taking such a toll on the hags. He glimpsed Cleric behind the captain, Wyatt and bald and obviously not human. Even from a distance, his mark blotted out his inhuman physical beauty, stained him with gut-wrenching ugliness. The stream glittered, a ribbon of liquid obsidian in the gloom. The air smelt of clay and cold rot. "They were the only ones, really," she finally said. "The twins. I was there, you know. There from the beginning with them. I saw them drawn, squalling from Mother's womb." She paused to watch her booted feet pick steps across the ground. "I think that was the only moment I truly, truly loved her."
"You never stopped loving her," Akamian said. "You wouldn't care to hate her otherwise."
Anger shrouded her eyes once again, but to her credit, she managed to purge it from her voice. She was trying, the old wizard realized. She wanted to trust him. Even more, she wanted to understand what he saw when he looked upon her. Perhaps too desperately.
"What do you mean?"
No love is simple, my Mara. Something hooked his voice while saying this, something like weak eyes in a burning throat. At least no love worth the name. But nothing, he said. Far too many of us confuse complexity for impurity, or even pollution. Far too many of us mourn what we should celebrate as a result. Life is unruly, my Mara. Only tyrants and fools think otherwise. She frowned in a mock here-we-go-again manner. A gensis? She asked, her eyes bright and teasing. No, just wisdom. Not everything I say is borrowed, you know. She walked in silence for a time, her smile fading into a look of puzzled concentration. Akamian paced her in silence. She resumed her account, describing the imperial twins, Kelmomus and Samarmus. The latter was indeed an idiot, as Akamian had heard. But according to Maimara, the imperial physicians had feared both children were idiots in the beginning. Apparently the two infants would simply stare into each other's eyes, day after day, month after month, then year after year. If separated, they ceased to eat, as if they shared but one appetite between the two of them. It was only after Esmanet contracted a celebrated physician from Conraya that their two souls were finally pried apart, and the idiocy of Samarmus was revealed. "It was a wonder," Maimara exclaimed, as if reliving the memories of their cure in a rush, "to be so strange, and then to waken as, well, beautiful little boys, normal in all respects. You were fond of them. How could I not be? They were innocents born into a labyrinth, a place devious beyond compare. The others could never see it, no matter how much they complained and clucked. They could never see the Endymion Heights for what it was. And what was that? A prison, a carnival, and a temple most of all, one where sins were counted according to harms endured rather than inflicted. It was no place for children. I told Mother as much. Told her to take the twins to one of the refuge estates, some place where they could grow in the light of the sun, where things were... They had stopped to make their way beneath the fallen tree he'd seen earlier. So he supposed she had trailed to better concentrate. The limbs of the giant had folded and snapped, either bending back or prying deep into the earth. Dead leaves hung in rasping sheets. Finding passage was no easy task. "Where things were what?" he asked, when it became apparent she did not care to continue.
"Simple," she said dully.
Akamian smiled in his wise old teacher way. The thought occurred to him that she had sought to protect the memory of her own childhood, as much as the innocence of her two little brothers. But he said nothing. People rarely appreciate alternative, self-serving interpretations of their conduct, especially when suffering ruled the balance of their lives. "Let me guess," he ventured. "Your mother refused, said that they would need to learn the perils and complexities of statecraft to survive as princes imperial." "Something like that," she replied. "So you trusted him. Kelmomus, I mean." "Trusted?" she cried with open incredulity. "He was a child. He adored me to the point of annoyance." She fixed him with a vexed look, as if to say, "Enough, old man. He was the reason I ran away to find you, in fact." Something troubled the old wizard about this. But as so often happens in the course of heated conversations, his worries yielded to the point he hoped to press home. "Yes, but he was a child of Kellis, and a Nasarimber by blood. So? So that means he possesses Dunyain blood, like in Rilatis." They had sloshed across the stream, and were now climbing the far side of the gully. They could see the rest of the company above them, a string of frail forms laboring beneath the monumental trunks. "Ah, I keep forgetting," she said, huffing. "I suppose he simply must be manipulative and amoral." She regarded him the way he imagined she had regarded countless others on the Endymion Heights, as something ridiculous. "You've been cooped in the wilds too long, wizard. Sometimes a child is just a child. That's all they know, my Mara. The Dunyane. They're bred for it. She dismissed him with a flutter of eyelids. She had no inkling, he realized, like everyone else in the Three Seas. For her, Kellis was simply what he appeared to be. In the first years of his exile, the hardest years, Akamian had spent endless hours revisiting the events of the First Holy War. His memories of Kellis and Esmenet most of all. The more he pondered the man, the more obvious the Skilvendi's revelatory words came to seem, until it became difficult to remember what it was like living within the circuit of his glamour. To think he had still loved the man after he had lured Esmenet to his bed. That he had spent sleepless hours wrestling with excuses. Excuses! For him. But even still, after so many years, the appearances continued to argue for the man. Everything Maimara had described regarding the preparations for the great ordeal, even the scalpers accompanying him, attested to what Kellis had claimed so many years previous, that he had been sent to prevent the second apocalypse. Akamian had suffered that old sense several times now while feuding with Maimara, the one that had plagued him as a mandate schoolman traveling the courts of the Three Seas, arguing the very things Kellis had made religion. And there was an irony that plucked, if there ever was one. The anxious urge to throw words atop words, as if speaking could plaster over the cracked expressions that greeted his claims. The plaintive, wheedling sense of being disbelieved. Maybe you need it, old man. Need to be disbelieved. He had seen it before. Men who had borne perceived injustices so long they could never relinquish them, and so continually revisited them in various guises. The world was filled with self-made martyrs. Fear goads fear, the old Manser proverb went, and sorrow, sorrow. Perhaps he was mad. Perhaps everything, the suffering, the miles, the lives lost and taken, was not but a fool's errand. As wrenching as this possibility was, and as powerful as the Skilvendi's words had been, Akamian would have been entirely prepared to accept his folly. He was a true student of Agensis in this respect. Were it not for his dreams, and the coincidence of the coffers. The old wizard continued on in silence, mulling the details of Maimara's tale. The picture she had drawn was as fascinating as it was troubling. Kellis, perpetually distracted, perpetually absent, his children possessing a jumble of human and Dunyane attributes, and half mad for it, apparently. Games heaped upon games, and sorrow and resentment most of all. Esmenet had fetched her broken daughter from the brothel only to deliver her to the arena that was the Endymion Heights, a place where no soul could mend. Not hers, and certainly not her daughter's. Was this not a kind of proof of Kellis? Pain followed him, as did tumult and war. Every life that fell into his cycle suffered some kind of loss or deformation. Was this not an outward sign of his evil? Perhaps. Perhaps not. Suffering had ever been the wages of revelation. The greater the truth, the greater the pain. No one understood this quite so profoundly as he. Either way, it was proof of Maimara. Our words always paint two portraits when we describe our families to others. Outsiders cannot but see the small peeves and follies that wrinkle our relationships with our loved ones. The claims we make in defensive certainty, that we were the one wronged, that we were the one who wanted the best, cannot but fall on skeptical ears, since everyone but everyone makes the same claims of virtue and innocence. We are always more than what we want to be in the eyes of others, simply because we are blind to the bulk of what we are. Kellis had taught him that. Maimara had wanted him to see her as a victim,
as a long-suffering penitent, more captive than daughter, and not as someone embittered and petulant, someone who often held others accountable for her inability to feel safe, to feel anything unpolluted by the perpetual pang of shame. And he loved her the more for it. Later, as the murk of evening steeped through the forest galleries, she slowed so that he could draw abreast, but she did not return his questioning gaze. "What I told you," she eventually said, "that was foolish of me."
"What was foolish?"
"What I said." This final exchange left him sorting through melancholy thoughts of his own family and the wretched Narani village where he had been born. They seemed strangers now, not simply the people who inhabited his childhood memories, but the passions as well. The doting love of his sisters, even the tyranny of his father, the maniacal shouts, the wordless beatings, seemed to belong to some soul other than his own. This, he realized, this was his true family, the mad children of the man who had robbed him of his wife, the new Anasarimber dynasty. These were his brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, and this simply meant that he had no family, that he was alone, save for the mad woman trekking beside him, his little girl. Back when he had been a tutor in Aeognisis, he took up the antique Canaan practice of considering problems while walking. Peripatetics, the ancients had called it. He would trudge down from his apartment by the Primparian barracks, through the wooded pathways of the quay, and down to the port, where the masts made a winter forest of the piers. There was this defunct temple, where he would always glimpse the same beggar through a breach in the walls. He was one of those unraveled men, unkempt and withered, slow-moving and speechless, as if dumbfounded at where the years had delivered him. And for some reason, it always knocked a Camion from his stride seeing him. He would pass, gazing, his walk slowing to a numb saunter, and the beggar would simply stare off, beyond caring who did or did not watch. A Camion would forget whatever problem he had set off to ponder, and brood instead about the cruel alchemy of age and love and time. A fear would clutch him, knowing that this was true solitude, to find yourself the feeble survivor, stranded at the end of your life, your loves and hopes reduced to remembered smoke, hungering, suffering, and waiting. Waiting most of all. His mother was dead, the old wizard supposed.